When you begin to break down some of the key differences between legacy HR and modern HR, one of the things that really becomes a centralized trait of modern people leaders is their business acumen. Modern people executives are business operators that focus on people, and that allows them to really understand the strategy of the organization and develop people programs that really align to them in ways that can make a significant difference. And I'm really excited to be joined today by the head of people operations for Asana, Anna Binder. Anna is a seasoned HR executive with a deep HR acumen, but also a deep business acumen. And in this podcast, she talks about how she weaves those things together to develop transformative and sustainable people practices at Asana. So we are going to get into that conversation after a brief word from our sponsor. 21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey everyone, welcome to the 21st Century HR Podcast. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt, and today I am very excited to be joined by the head of people operations of Asana, Anna Binder. We're going to talk about Anna's career path and some of the hyper-growth efforts that she's led at Asana and what that people program looks like when you're in that stage. So Anna, thanks so much for coming on. Why don't you just take a moment and introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure, Lars, great to be here with you. My name is Anna Binder. I run people operations for Asana. I've pretty much done people operations for most of my career, starting, back in the late 90s, my goodness. And I've had the opportunity to lead HR for a number of companies going from, four people to into over 1,000. And I've been at Asana for about 3.5 years.
Awesome. And I will make a deep mental note that last name is Binder and not Binder. So I apologize for butchering that on the intro. I got Anna right and I butchered Binder. Let's talk. You mentioned a little bit about your career and how that's evolved. And I definitely want to spend a lot of time digging into what you've built at Asana, because I think you have some pretty incredible programs there. But before we get to Asana, I want to kind of rewind back. You've been in HR most of your career. You've seen a variety of senior kind of top people leadership roles during that time. What initially drew you to HR?
It's funny. I get this question a lot, and I don't think anyone grows up and says, when I grow up, I want to be a HR person or a people ops person. Like, who has ever said that? Zero people. The real story is that after college, I traveled around the world for a couple of years and just took advantage of the fact that I was young and willing to willing to sleep just about everywhere or anywhere and explore different cultures. And when then that wrapped up, I ended up in San Francisco and I started my job search. And, when you've never had a job and you don't know what you want to do, your criteria in terms of looking is really limited. You actually don't even know how to assess. And I remember it pretty clearly. I had three job opportunities given to me. I had three offers in 1 week. And it was, like I said, it was the late 90s and it was a heyday of the internet in San Francisco. Oh, yeah. I ended up working for a man and joining a company based solely on the fact that I thought I wanted to follow him. He seemed really impressive. He was a rigorous interviewer. I believed in his vision. I believed in his leadership and I as much as I could. And I started out doing everything. I was part HR, part recruiting, part like legal. I coordinated the board meetings. I was his assistant. Sometimes I sat at the front desk. I definitely paid all the bills. Like I did everything. And we were a 10-person startup. You know, we eventually grew that, that company to 300 people. And, bit by bit, parts of my job got quote unquote taken away. And, you know, the interesting part of the story, because, you know, when it got taken away because different, more people were hired and, you know, we started building these functions. And I still remember at one point he said to me, you know, you can do, you've really added a lot of value here. You're early in career. You actually get to do whatever you want. Tell me what you want to do. And I was like, I want to do corporate development. And he laughed. He said, why do you want to do corporate development? And I said, well, it just seems like there's smart people over there doing smart stuff. Like, I just want to go be with them. And he laughed, not with me, but at me. He truly laughed at me. He said, don't be an idiot. He said, you're really good at this HR stuff and it comes naturally to you and you're having tremendous impact. Like do the things in life that bring you joy and that you're good at. All of the success will happen after that. It will naturally follow. And I said, but John, whenever I go to a party and I tell people that I work in HR, they roll their eyes. I don't want to work in a function that people roll their eyes at. That just doesn't feel good. And, you know, so we had a set of conversations, but I said, okay, well, you know what? I'll try it. I'll see how it goes. And eventually, you know, I built the capability. I got better at it. I moved to another company. I got mentorship from other people that were not in HR, but that believed in the function. And I, you know, bit by bit, I built my capability and my strength there. And eventually I just shifted. And I said, I don't see a lot of people in the function at that time that I looked up to, that I felt like would really teach me something. And it felt a little bit lonely and it hurt my ego to have people roll their eyes. But eventually I shifted and I just said, like, I actually really love this work. I believe in its impact. It's, I actually think it's what I'm good at. So maybe I can just do it. And then eventually I can be one of those people that other people that are starting their careers can look to and say, I want to be like that. And it's, I can't tell you how, gratifying it is to be able to do work that you feel like you are meant to be doing and to have impact on human beings and on businesses. I feel like an ocean of good fortune and very, very blessed.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the story about the kind of cocktail party of people rolling their eyes, because I've heard that analogy, you know, before. And I think that it is, if you look at kind of legacy personnel, there absolutely is that stigma. But what's so exciting, and I think you certainly are very much immersed in the space, and I think a leader in the space, is when you look at kind of next generation people practices, it's a very different function. The capabilities are very different. The impact is very different. And with that, the respect is very different. So it's definitely come a long way since, you know, the days when I think people looked at the function and just kind of, you know, did not want anything to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think you see it in a lot of places, right? Like I get as many requests for sort of, to pick my brain, quote unquote, from up and coming HR people as I do from, founders and CEOs who are invested in scaling their culture and want some advice on how to do that. I think that, you know, we happen to live here in Silicon Valley and I work at places that are fast growing. So the investment in the culture and the function is really elevated here, but I think it's only going one direction and I believe in it.
Yeah. And so for you, I mean, you've over the last 10 years, you've had leadership roles, HR executive roles in a variety of companies, and you've had kind of a front row seat into the evolution of that role, whether it's, you know, and this is much broader than just title from, you know, CHRO to chief people officer, head of people. Like when you think of how your role, and not your role specifically at Asana, but just the role of a CPO has evolved over the last 5 years, what's different?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that the biggest difference is that there's three different ways to think about the work the people related work or the culture related work, right? There is the, hey, I'm trying to get product market fit, or I'm trying to get a product to market, or I'm trying to get from, you know, 5 to 20 million in revenue. I can't really focus on culture and values and people. I have to focus on these things, and I have to focus on fundraising, right? And that stuff is a distraction. So me as the CEO, I'm going to outsource that either to a head of people or to somebody else. Then there's the other type of CEO who says, you know what? It's not a distraction. We can actually balance the two. We can spend time building the business, and we can spend time building the culture. And the thing that I think is more true today than ever, and is 100% true at Asana, and one of the reasons that I originally came and that I feel like I'm thriving here, is this concept that that is a false trade-off. It is right. Actually your investment in culture and your commitment to defining and making the values real that will drive your business success and ultimately enable you to achieve your mission. And it's not either or, and it's not a balance. One drives the other. And I think that there's the one of the big evolutions for me in the role is that people, that shift in perception on the work of culture building and culture evolving that has driven that change. And that is not the role it's not the sole role of the chief people officer. It's like an all team sport, you know, and at Asana, I experience it at the board level where they want to know what we're doing to evolve our culture. So the leadership team, if you look at our weekly leadership team meeting, I would say 50% of the topics are either people or culture related. Every employee here feels like they are participating in evolving the culture. And so my job is as an orchestrator of that, but not, and I don't feel like I'm in a room in the corner thinking about culture.
Yeah, well, you know, that's such a great point, because I think if you look at the CPO role today, and whatever title, you know, it may go by, to me, I think it's one of the most dynamic and frankly difficult positions in the C-suite, because the reality is the role and the function has evolved, and the expectations, especially in leading organizations, has evolved. You know, you have to have a business acumen and a financial acumen that is, you know, on par with your CFO. You have to understand the sales and revenue on par with the chief revenue officer. You have to understand the marketing strategy and brand positioning. And then you have to tie all those things with the organizational strategy back to the people strategy and drive that. It's so complex and multifaceted that is just, I think, is evolved, you know, far beyond what a traditional head of HR was, you know, again, even five years ago.
I totally agree. And not only do you need to understand those things, right? And I think of myself as a business person who happens to be having impact on the business through this function called people operations.
Yeah.
So in order to be successful, not only do I need to understand those components of the business, but I actually need to really care and be interested in them.
Right.
And, right. Like I need to engage and think about them and think about how our people strategy supports and partners with them. You know, one of my one of my common interview questions for people ops people that come here to Asana, and this is a pro tip, but they need to be able to explain to me the business model of the companies that they've been at, how those companies make, what the model is, how they make money, what the gross margins are, what the risks are, who the competitors are, what the growth rates are. And I'm not talking about like headcount growth rates. I'm talking about revenue growth rates.
Right. And
if you don't know that, I don't know how you can really build people programs to enable the company to achieve its mission.
Wow, well, that's actually a great question, and I hope some of your future team members are listening to this podcast and come prepared for that question, because but you're right. I think from a business operations standpoint, that's a quick way of gauging how tuned in they are to the business, as opposed to just their domain. So let's dig more into Asana. So you've been kind of leading the people ops team there for the last 3 years. For listeners who may not be familiar with Asana, if you could just give a brief overview of what the company does and then kind of how it's grown during the past 3 years.
Sure. So Asana is a work management platform, and it helps teams collaborate more effortlessly. Everything from like huge projects to small tasks. people, you know, our customers include large banks and manufacturing companies to small mom and pop flower shops that need to coordinate delivery. I actually also use it to run my own household with my roommate slash husband to make sure that all the things get done, from, you know, the chores to the vacations to the child drop-offs and pickups. So that's what Asana does. I've been here for about 3.5 years. When I joined, we were 125 people. We are now 600 people. When I started, we had about 10,000 paying customers. Now we're over 70,000. And we've grown from one office, our headquarters in San Francisco, to 7 offices globally.
And so from a people operations standpoint, what does your team look like? Like, what is it? How are you kind of established to support that that kind of employee base and that growth?
Sure. So we'll kind of go from left to right. You can imagine a whiteboard that I'm drawing. It starts with recruiting. And to me, the recruiting function is, the size of the recruiting function is purely a function of how many people you have to recruit, right? Like what's your headcount growth? What's your attrition? How do you map that? And our recruiting includes functional recruiting, so technical and business recruiting. It includes a sourcing team and a talent research team, operations, and then a candidate experience team. Then I also have a diversity and inclusion person who has a lot of dotted line people, and we can talk a little bit about that a little bit later in the podcast. The third is just the ops of people ops. So compensation, operations, compliance, all the analytics, and that's a significant team. Then we have what we call a growth and impact team. A lot of people might call this the HR business partners and talent development. We call it growth and impact because we think it allows people to grow and increase their impact. And then I have somebody that runs organizational strategy. This is at Asana, the annual planning process or the mechanism by which we come up with our annual plan, the financial plan, the objectives and the roadmap and how that all fits together. That's run out of my team. And so I've got a woman that runs that. And then I have an employee communications person who supports employee engagement by thinking about what are we saying to employees? How are we connecting that to what we're saying externally? Runs all of the all hands, all of that.
Got it. And so, over the last 3.5 years, obviously you've definitely jumped in size. When you're kind of going through that scale process, what do you do differently? How do you adjust your, people programs when you're in that kind of hyper growth scaling mode to support
it? Sure. Well, I'll just say a few things that we've done just to be practical, and then maybe you can figure out a way to weave it together. That's your job, right?
That's my job. All right, I'll take it.
So one of the things that we recently did is we looked at our work in D&I. And we said, there's really a recruiting element of it, and then there's an inclusion element of it once people are in the door.
Sure.
And we looked at what a lot of companies do, and, typically there's a D&I team, and it sits either, inside of recruiting, or it sits inside of people operations. Sometimes it sits in a couple other places. But, one of the things that I looked at is these two activities or these two pieces of work, the recruiting and the inclusion, are very, very different. And it, particularly the recruiting piece, recruiting is a craft, and it is a specialized craft. It's not and it's very different from the work that you do in inclusion. And we said, really what it makes sense is to take the recruiting portion of the D&I work and embed it more deeply into the recruiting team. I think a lot of recruiters who, frankly, have such difficult jobs, see, while they emotionally and spiritually support the concepts behind the diversity recruiting, it can feel like, oh my gosh, this is making my life more difficult. And what we wanted to do is move the recruiting responsibilities around building a diverse workforce workforce more intimately into recruiting and really closer to the hiring manager and make it a core part of their work. So we've recently split that out, and we happen to have an amazing head of recruiting who wants this work to be core to her team's efforts. And so now our head of D&I is an advisor to that recruiting work, but she's not a recruiter and she's not a recruiting professional at all. So she really focuses, 90% of her energy on the inclusion work and just provides advisory work to the recruiting team on their work.
Right.
This has had a powerful impact in terms of making people, both recruiters and hiring managers, feel like it's a deeper part and it's more innate to their everyday work as opposed to this separate thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's important because a lot of organizations approach diversity. They over-index on the recruiting side, I think, so mm-hmm. It's about acquisition of talent. They don't focus as much on the inclusion and kind of integration and development of talent. But the other piece is, I think they're so focused there that they kind of view that as an add-on thing. It's not really mm-hmm. integrated into how they operate and how they mm-hmm. behave. And extending through the recruiting team into the hiring teams, because ultimately... Mm-hmm. That's got to be woven all the way through. So it's interesting to hear you kind of map out how you've built that. If you kind of go in the other direction, so that there's lots of kind of conversation around the things that you need to do and what are kind of ideal practices when you're in growth and scale mode. But there's also oftentimes a lot of mistakes and you come about those learnings sometimes through missteps. So when you think about your own kind of path building there, with the benefit of hindsight, what might you have done differently?
Yeah, I have a few things. So I think when you first start out, really in the early days, your CEO or your founder spend 50-75% of their time building the team.
Yeah.
They just do pitch after pitch after pitch, whether it is to a potential candidate today or tomorrow, whether it is to an investor, whether it is to a customer. I think it's 90% of their time is spent pitching, and much of that time is spent pitching to candidates. Then you shift to the next step is, you've got a little recruiting team and you've got some hiring managers. And we, like many companies, the MO was, we're just going to hire as many great people as possible, as quickly as possible. What's the strategy? What's the approach? No, that's what we're going to do. And then you shift to a more, a professionalized recruiting function that frankly looks a lot like a sales function. You have candidate marketing, you have a headcount plan, you map that headcount plan to resourcing, whether it's number of recruiters or number of hiring managers. You also map it to what is the number of interviews that we need, phone interviews and on-site interviews. You have a funnel. What is the close rate that you can anticipate? And let's build from there. As part of that transition, you move from kind of a transactional relationship between recruiting and hiring managers to a deeper partnership that is really like a longer term talent partnership. I would say if I were to do it again, I would have driven and directed that shift earlier. It's the type of thing. It's just the type of thing that, a month or a quarter can slip by and your headcount, if you're growing rapidly and your headcount is growing and your revenue is growing, the game gets bigger real, real fast. And recruiting is a contact sport in the Bay Area. It's incredibly competitive, for talent, but also for recruiting leaders. Yeah. And if I were to do it again, I would have invested there earlier, which might have meant breaking some eggs earlier, frankly. But that took me longer to do that than it should have. And it was a mistake.
I think, you touch on a point that I think a lot of, people in the recruiting space will recognize and kind of relate to. It's there's a difference between a transactional recruiter who's just focused on bringing people in the door and a real talent advisor. Right, who has the trust and the relationship with the hiring managers and can influence. And, they're still a great recruiter, so they're still great at identifying talent and getting talent excited and bringing them in. But they mm-hmm. also have that kind of, that deep understanding of the departments they support and the teams they support and the leaders they support. So they could really, when it's time to, you know, influence around a candidate, you know, maybe a hiring manager didn't see something in the background, but the recruiter did. And they can really say, look, I know, you know, you're looking for something with X, but trust me, you need to really, you know, consider this person because of, and that carries weight. That's a huge difference than kind of transactional recruiters that are just kind of flipping over resumes and profiles.
Absolutely. And I think in reflecting on my work for this chat, one of the things I'm most proud of with our PeopleOps team at Asana is that I am now actually, you know, obviously I lead the team, but in some situations I show up as a client of the team. So I'm my recruiting, the person who runs recruiting for PeopleOps sits down with me on a monthly basis and asks me, has a series of questions about like, what's keeping you up at night? Let's look at your calendar. What are you spending time on? What are your monthly priorities? And they're asking those questions because those things will give hint to them of what I'm going to come and say, I need to recruit for X, Y, and Z. So she will sometimes come and she says, you know, 3 months ago, you talked about this. Is this still a problem for you or have you solved it? And when I say to her, hey, and now we're going to hire for this, she's like, yeah, I figured that based on our last conversation. So I've already got a plan for how we might approach that here. What do you think about this? And it's amazing, right? It is that's not transactional at all. She's asking me questions to and gleaning in between the lines of what she can anticipate and then doing the work without me even being involved to prepare for that. That to me is like deep partnership and anticipatory work that I'm so happy that our leaders here have the benefit of.
Yeah, well, it's again, when you have that kind of intuitive relationship where you can, you know, as I say, kind of see around corners of what's coming and actually, you know, get to where your mind is going before it's even there. Like that's invaluable. Like you just can't, you know, you can't put a price tag on that level of capability and service. One of the things I want to spend a little bit more time with you on is I know that, you know, diversity and inclusion and belonging has been a big part of your people strategy at Asana. And, you know, you take a holistic approach that really centers around three pillars of build, recruit, and thrive. And I'm curious, you know, you've done a variety of work in this space, but if you had to zero in on kind of one initiative, one program, one approach that you felt has been most impactful at Asana, what do you think that would be?
Great question. I'm a politician in training, so you asked me for one, I'm going to give you three.
I'll take three.
So first of all, I want to talk about compensation.
Yeah.
You know, tying this to your earlier question of like things that we've evolved, you know, early days in a startup, and Asana is no different, compensation's kind of done ad hoc. Like each group does it in a slightly different way. Each manager might do it in a slightly different way. And there is some data and there's some, you know, like best efforts made, but it, you know, compensation changes happen all over the place, all over the year with very little rationalization, very little budget, very little analysis. And one of the things that we've really overhauled, we did this in my first year here, is we put some structure around that. First of all, we like mapped the jobs, we created a leveling system, we bought some more robust data. We put in systems where compensation was reviewed at a cadence where all people were reviewed together multiple times a year. And that, I think, it gave managers greater confidence in the decisions that we were making. The analysis and structure around it ensured that we were making more equitable decisions and that you could compare apples to apples in a more meaningful way. I think, you know, a lot of people look at sort of some of that more wonky operational stuff as like, not about culture, but it is actually everything about culture. And it ensures, you know, part of people making sure that everyone can thrive is making sure that you're paying people appropriately and that you can explain why you're paying them what that you are paying them. And, you know, traditionally or historically, or I would say naturally, that is where some people get screwed. And putting structure around that is a really important step that you can take to ensure that you're thriving. The second thing that I want to talk about is our Real Talk series. And this is a series of events that is done in partnership between Diversity and Inclusion and our events team. That are some are internal events and some are external events. And they are just that. They are real talk. What's, you know, some things that we've done in the past include, what's it like to be the only female engineering manager in an ocean of men? What's it like to be Black in America? What is the true immigrant experience? So some of these are done in partnership with other companies. And so we'll have people from other companies. Some of them are just Asana employees, but the talk is real and it's not always pretty, but it really gives people an insight and it allows people to demonstrate both the courage and vulnerability to talk about these things publicly. And it's an education opportunity for people. And it helps drive a sense of belonging for all of us. So the third thing, and this is over half of our employees are members of at least one employee resource group at Asana, and it's an active, vibrant part of our community here. One of the things, I think a lot of companies have gone this route of creating ERGs and of making them front and center to their inclusion work. One of the things that we've done in the last year is look to professionalizing that work. I think especially whether it's our ERG participation, but more importantly, ERG leadership, right? Like each one of our ERG has two leaders. And I was just feeling that people saw this as sort of like work along the side or extracurricular work or, you know, nobody, like it was just something that you did after hours and it was like, you know, nice to have. And one of the things that we wanted to do was shift it to be really more core to your work. So we did a number of things to professionalize our ERGs. We ran a recruitment process to identify and assess and select the leaders. We engaged managers to say, this is a wonderful opportunity. You should look for people up and coming, like rising stars in your organization. And this is an opportunity to give them a career opportunity. We got buy-in from the most senior leadership to allow to support 20% of their time going to this ERG work. We built a year-long set of capability trainings that would help those ERG leads be successful in their role, but also give them skills that would allow them to be successful after their ERG commitment ended and would allow them to grow their career. So we really did a lot to we increased their budgets. We taught them how to use those budgets and how to think about connecting those budgets to the strategic goals of the ERG. I think making this, investing in the leadership there and professionalizing it sent a message to the whole company. This isn't like this little thing on the side. This is core.
Right. Well, and I think, building it the way you did kind of instills almost an entrepreneurial sense within each of the groups to kind of drive them in the direction that they see fit, as opposed to kind of the company saying, okay, well, here's a thing. And the approach that some companies take, it just feels like it's an additional thing that, isn't always genuine. And so I think kind of hearing how you've built it that way, I could see how that would connect. And obviously having, more than half of your employees involved in ERG speaks to the impact it's having. When you think about the conversation, I think, especially when you think about 21st century in HR, modern HR, legacy HR, I think the conversation was really focused around diversity, and everything. Mm-hmm. And it almost framed it as if it's this transaction. And I think that the conversation now, especially for modern companies, is really more focused on inclusion and belonging. And I'm curious, mm-hmm. for you, how do you go about measuring the impact of these programs? How do you get a handle on kind of how this is impacting the sense of belonging within Asana?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think about it in a few different ways. There are some quantitative and some qualitative ways that we can measure belonging. We do engagement surveys three times a year. we have somewhere between 90 and 95% of Asanas participate in our engagement survey. So it's not a representative sample. It's like a whole, it's a whole view.
Right.
So obviously, we have a number of questions in there about that speak to belonging. We are able to a certain degree, slice and dice that data to understand where the senses of where the sense of belonging is across different demographic groups, and that is a pretty crystal clear mirror to us about belonging. But there are also we look at exit interview surveys and try to glean information from there. And we do more qualitative or sort of personal interview type things to get a sense of it. So the ERG leads will give us a pulse of it on a quarterly basis. You know, we actually had one group that the engagement survey scores were pretty low, and our head of inclusion pulled everyone from that minority group together for a lunch and essentially said, are you willing to share with me your ideas on what we could do better? And of the 15 people she invited, 14 attended, including one that was on parental leave who got on the phone because they were so interested in participating in the topic. They were positive, they were constructive, they were engaged, and they were specific. And she brought that to the leadership team and said, I'm going to make some changes and I need your support.
Oh, well, I think when you have that environment where everybody is that comfortable, you know, giving that real feedback, you know, because obviously without it, without having an environment where employees feel safe to have that level of candor and really kind of give specific direction and examples of what you can do to make them feel kind of more integrated and part of and you know, kind of belonging within the organization, I think that that's hugely important. And not all companies get that, you know, so I think they struggle with it because they don't, for one, just have an environment where it does have a strong sense of belonging and people feel like they can raise their perspectives and they won't just be heard, but they'll be acted on.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we do in onboarding, on day one, we have a certain goals for day one. And one of the goals is to make sure that people understand that there's not only an opportunity, but there's an expectation of every employee to participate in co-creating the culture. And we give them very specific apps. We don't tell them how to do it. We really encourage them to look for ways to do that themselves. But we outline like half a dozen ways that they can do it, that, you know, from the light, medium to hardcore. But we think, you know, one of the most common comments on our engagement survey is, wow, I'm amazed at how well our culture is scaling. That's not what I'm doing. That's not what the leadership is doing. The employees are doing this. All I'm doing is creating reasonable and authentic avenues for people to engage in scaling our culture. And from there, it takes off.
Yeah. So you're saying you don't own the culture as the head of people. That's that's shocking.
Well, I look, I'm an orchestrator.
Yeah.
I'm a facilitator. I've got what is the conductor that has a little baton with the symphony? I definitely have that.
Yeah.
But that's different than owning it. If you put the responsibility for owning the culture on one human being, that's not scalable. We've got 15 people in an office in Sydney. We've got 4 people in an office in Tokyo. I need every single one of those individuals. I can't be there every day. I need every one of those individuals to feel like that they have full responsibility for participating in the culture just the way that I feel this responsibility. And only with that. Now, I need to shape it. I need to give them swimming lanes or guardrails.
Sure.
I need to help people understand how, what the priorities are and how the culture drives the business. But if you do that and you do it well and you do it until you are exhausted and blue in the face, good things will happen because people step up.
Yeah, well, you're right. And I kind of mentioned that in jest about owning it. I think that there's this this perception that maybe this ties back again to more legacy HR where they're like, oh yeah, you know, HR owns culture. And that's, you know, that's BS. Like you can be a conductor, you can try to create programs in place that that allow employees to thrive. And obviously that enables culture, but you know, they don't own the culture and they don't, you know, they're not solely responsible for the culture. And so I think to me, that is certainly one of the core aspects of 21st century HR. And I'm curious to get your perspective. You know, when you think about 21st century HR, modern HR, how would you define it?
That is a good question. We could talk for an hour.
Yeah.
We could talk for an hour. Look, to me, this concept that your investment in the culture drives your business results and enables you to achieve your mission, that to me is that 21st century HR. That's my North Star.
Yeah.
That is everything. I guess I will also say, relatedly, I think that at the end of the day, there's a lot of conversation about what drives engagement. I've come to believe through my work at Asana that there are two things that drive engagement over and above everything else. The first is, does my work matter? And am I working on stuff that matters? Right? Like, and those right. are, those use some of the same words, but they mean different things, right? Yeah. How can I connect the work that I'm doing up to the bigger project or up to the bigger objective? And how does that objective connect to the company's strategy and ultimately allow us to achieve our mission? When I'm putting in that one extra hour, or I'm trying to figure out how to prioritize between two tasks that seem equally important, but I only have time for one of them, how do I connect it? And does it really matter? And so for us at Asana, we have the beauty of the product and we have something called the Pyramid of Clarity, which allows us to connect tasks to projects, to objectives, to the mission. And like I said earlier about making yourself blue in the face in terms of helping people see how their work connects to the broader picture, that is a fundamental driver of employee engagement, which in turn allows employees to increase their impact. The second thing I think that is the fundamental driver of engagement is belonging. I might not look and feel and smell like everyone else around me, but am I in an environment where my voice is heard, where I can mostly be my full self, where it's okay to show vulnerability? And we've invested tremendously here in exactly that, trying to create that sense of belonging, part of which is ensuring that expressing vulnerability is a core leadership trait that is not only allowed, but encouraged, celebrated, and held to account for.
Right.
Those two things, like, I think that's the modern workplace. And 21st century HR are enabling those two things and making them alive. Always, not just because they're the right things to do, but because they will help your organization achieve its mission.
Yeah, and I'm glad you touched on vulnerability, because I think that is such an important distinction around modern leadership in general, but I think especially even at the CPO and CHRO level, because I think historically, you know, that role was often in some organizations siloed away, in other organizations, you know, just kind of viewed by employees as robotic, or you don't want to interact with that person. They can't relate to your needs. And what I'm seeing more and more of, and obviously you mentioned this and I've seen this with you and many others, is that leaders are being able to be more vulnerable and show up who they are. And I think relate and connect with their employees in ways that legacy HR executives couldn't, because they see them as going through similar things, experiencing similar challenges, having developmental needs in certain areas. They don't have to have all the answers. They don't have to be perfect. And I think that they're okay with that. And that's actually encouraged. And I think employees and ultimately organizations can connect so much better with that kind of leadership, because they can just relate in ways that I think they couldn't to kind of models of HR executives in the past.
Yeah, it's a much nicer way to work. It makes coming to work joyful.
Yeah, I mean, that's who wants to be able to leave the majority of themselves at the door when they show up? Like, that's exhausting.
I mean, it's so fascinating to me, and it really didn't because it came into such crystallization for me at Asana, because I spent most of my career and you know, enterprise software, high ASP, like very male dominated in environments. And I don't mean male dominated in terms of like that there's a lot of men, but just like the energy is really male.
Right.
And I in reflection, I realized that a lot of the conversations and the meetings that I would go into, I'd go into like with like as if I was like ready for a knife fight. You know what I mean? Like my stance was like ready to fight, and I had my, you know, I had my business case, and I was ready to be forceful and make my case and convince people and like really like bring it. And oftentimes those with the most forceful energy won, right? Like they won.
Right.
And sometimes the people with the loudest voices or the people who yelled the most won. And it was really a profound shift to come into a place where it's like, hey, let's start by getting grounded that we're all on the same page and we're all on the same team. We might actually be on the same page, but we're on the same team and we have the same goal to get to the best outcome. And we have different experiences and those experiences influence our opinions, but reasonable people can disagree and let's be open and curious to points of view that are not our own. That is profoundly different.
Yeah. And on the last question I want to cover with you is the, you mentioned kind of at the beginning of the podcast, you know, an aspiration of being the leader that people that are up and coming to space can kind of look to for inspiration and mm-hmm. for a way to work. And I think you've certainly become that, but I'm curious from your perspective, when you think about the people who inspire you in the industry, people who you look to for, you know, inspiration, ideas, people that you just think are leading the industry forward. What leaders come to mind for you?
Great question. I guess I'll give you a few answers. The first, like I find myself increasingly inspired by the people that I was hoping to inspire. These, like younger up and coming folks who just, their paradigm is just, it's different and their assumptions are different. And they come at it with a completely different point of view. And, you know, I recently went to a round table on benefits and how fast growing companies were looking at benefits. And I have to tell you real talk. I don't spend a lot of time on benefits. I've got an ops team. They look at it. I think about it maybe two or three times a year, but I specifically wanted to go because I wanted to get just one click closer to it and see what was happening in the marketplace so that I wasn't to sort of unblock myself from my, like everything, all the experience that I had and, you know, all the assumptions. And it was amazing. I was in a room with people who'd been in the workforce for 3 or 4 years and had just completely different points of view about what the role of a company is in supporting the health and well-being of employees. And I actually think we do an amazing job here at Asana, but it was just so inspiring to see like the leapfrogging that was happening with from some of these younger folks. So that's definitely inspiring. The second thing that I'm inspired by is some of these, you know, founder CEOs who are 5, 10, 50 people, you know, just working on product market fit and who care so deeply about this work and are hungry to be better at it and are actively investing time to educate themselves. That's pretty cool. That's, yeah. You know, if I look back 10 years ago, a lot of the VCs that I know who really did already believe in culture and its differentiating power, they would call me and ask me to go talk to one of their CEOs to convince the CEO that culture mattered. And like, that's not happening. Now these CEOs are coming to me directly saying, this really matters. Please, please give me some time. So that's pretty cool. The last thing, and this is a pretty easy answer, but and I've said it before, you know, Dustin Moskovitz is the founder and CEO of Asana. And I got to tell you, I have learned more about mindfulness, equanimity, and being truly open and curious to opinions that are different from your own, from that man, than I think that I've learned in my life.
Wow. Well, that's I think having that relationship. I mean, the relationship between a head of people and a CEO is so important. But particularly, like the things you're talking about aren't necessarily work things. They're not business things. They're life things. And I think that just is transformative. Yeah. Well, Anna, I really appreciate you making time to come on the podcast and share your wisdom. I enjoyed it and I learned a lot. So thanks so much for making time.
Thanks, Lars. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.